listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, interesting new study out saying that about a third of our manufacturing jobs that have vanished since 2000 have vanished to China. This is the direct result of our insane trade policies. This is not, you know, blame it on China. It's blame it on the stupidity of the United States. It's nuts. Meanwhile, pensions are collapsing. When Reagan came into office, 80% of full-time workers had a pension. Now it's less than 20%. It's amazing. You know, when Reagan came into office, about 80% of college education was paid for, you know, of tuition was paid for, or the cost of education, college education was paid for by state, local, and federal governments. Now it's about 20%. We pick up the tab for the rest. What do we do about this? You know, maybe we could learn a lesson from Sarah Palin. When the Royal Dutch Shell Kulig rig got stuck on the rocky shores of Alaska on New Year's Eve, the people of that state were paying very close attention. And it wasn't just because they worried about the potential for another environmental disaster in their backyard. It was because they pay attention very closely to their state's oil industry in general, because they all make a lot of money from it. Alaska is unique, and it has something called the Alaska Permanent Fund, believing that all residents of the state should profit off the resources that are naturally below their feet. Alaska takes the money the big oil corporations pay them in oil leases and royalties, invests that money, and then distributes the return on those investments to each and every resident of the state. So every year, every single man, woman, and child in Alaska gets a check for between $1,000 and $2,000 bucks on average. So if you're a husband and wife with two kids, you could earn as much as $8,000 at the end of the year. And that's not pocket change for a working family trying to make it during this Republican Great Recession. I'd say Republican Great Depression. Thanks to the supplemental income to each resident of Alaska, the state enjoys the third highest median income in the nation and is also the second most equal state in the nation. It's a system that works. It's been embraced by both Democrats and Republicans, even Sarah Palin. So why don't we do this in the rest of the country? I mean, we actually sort of already do apply it to the rest of the country, but only the billionaires, you know, get the checks. Right now, our entire economic model, largely controlled by the billionaire class, depends on enriching the lives of shareholders and business owners, but not average working class Americans. From Wall Street to big oil to the for-profit health insurance industry, business decisions are always made in the context of what's going to increase the wealth of the shareholders. And take a look at the Forbes 400 richest Americans, and you'll see a list of billionaires who collect most of their money in the form of non-labor dividend income from things that they own, like businesses, stock, land, infrastructure. Paris Hilton gets a steady stream of dividend checks from her family's hotel business. The Koch brothers get their regular checks in the mail courtesy of the massive energy conglomerate their dad built up, known as Koch Industries. Mitt Romney continues to collect his checks from Bain Capital. It's good to be a shareholder, or corporate owner in capitalist America, and that's all well and good. But aren't we all shareholders in our commons, just like the Alaskans are? And being such, shouldn't we collect dividends every time our commons turns a profit for others, just like Alaskans? In Alaska, the money that oil corporations pay to lease and extract oil on public lands is distributed to all Alaskans equally. So nationally, the money from oil and gas extraction could be distributed to Americans equally, too. In 2007, the U.S. government collected $9 billion in royalty payments from big oil on just the drilling done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just the drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. In reality, we should have collected a lot more, but the U.S. ranks 93rd in the world in how much revenue we get from oil and gas extraction compared to those profits that the industries enjoy. This has something to do with Ronald Reagan. From 1954 to 83, the average lease for federal land was $2,224 an acre. But after Reagan, from 83 to 2008, the average lease was just $263 an acre. not 2,200. Now, why that happened is a whole other rant, which we will get into some other time. But let me just suffice to say, it all began with Reagan.com. Anyhow, or it all started with Reagan.com. But still, $9 billion in royalties from just the Gulf of Mexico is a considerable chunk of change. And if we were going to distribute all that money equally to all Americans like they do in Alaska, it's about $30 a person. Now, when you consider everybody in the United States, that's it's not too much money. But when you throw in the leases and royalties paid everywhere else around the nation, I mean, keep in mind, that was just the Gulf of Mexico. We're drilling like crazy all over the place. Plus, we're pulling gas out of the ground like there's no tomorrow. We got coal mines, East Coast drilling platforms, fracking wells, Appalachian coal mines, oil derricks in the Midwest and Texas. You add all that stuff up, and if we did what Alaska does, you're talking serious money. Not only that, think of how much money is put into our common military to defend the interests of big oil abroad, to make sure that the shipping lanes stay open and the oil spigot keeps flowing. Big oil should contribute a fee for that service, which can also be added to this common permanent fund to be shared by all Americans. And what about making big oil pay for their pollution of the commons? Cap and trade system, which forces polluters to pay for how much carbon they dump into the atmosphere. Great start. Could raise even more money for our commons permanent fund to be shared by all of us. By the way, Nancy Pelosi passed such a thing, not that the money was shared, but a cap and trade system for carbon fuels. Got passed out of the House of Representatives. It had more than 50 votes in the Senate. The Republicans filibustered it. Another, you know, reason why we need filibuster reform. But I digress. The point is, our commons belong to all of us. Our mineral wealth belongs to all of us. It should be enriching all of us and not just the billionaires who've planted their flags in the ground. And it shouldn't stop at just oil. Wall Street relies heavily on our commons, too. Our markets are regulated by common government, enforced through common courts, and fueled by workers who are educated in our commons, our public school system. So how about a small financial transaction tax on every single trade, just a fraction of a penny, so that we, the shareholders in this nation, also get to see gains from a booming market? Or better yet, as entrepreneur and defender of the commons Peter Barnes proposes, we should all get a cut every time a company goes private. Barnes argues, quote, when a company like Facebook or Google goes public, its value rises dramatically. Experts call this liquidity premium, and is generated not by the company, but by society. This socially created wealth now flows mostly to a small number of Americans. Let's say we required public companies to deposit 1% of their shares in the common fund for 10 years, up to a total of 10%. In due time, the common fund would have the diversified portfolio worth trillions of dollars. Excuse me, I said when we take them private, I meant when we take them public. Now, consider the enormous profits that radio, TV, and entertainment companies receive by using our common air and infrastructure. Or publishers, our common copyright laws, or authors. I'm one of them. I make money off the copyright laws. I think I should be sharing that with everybody in the country because, you know, the copyright laws are part of the commons. It's not an enormous amount of money, but hey, what the heck? They, too, should be paying into the common fund. Add together all these rents for using our commons, and we, the people, have raised quite a bit of money for our common permanent fund that could go a long way to supplementing the annual incomes of millions of Americans who desperately need a bit more cash. Somehow, as capitalism was left to run amok in America over the last few decades, we forgot the important role our commons can play in enriching all of our lives. Rather than CEOs and billionaires paying us to use our commons, pollute our air and water, dictate our military missions, exploit our markets, hijack our radio, TV, airwaves, it's all been flipped upside down and we end up paying them. We give them subsidies, tax breaks, free usage. Come on. We need a national permanent fund. Let's do what Sarah Palin did.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I see people all over the country scrambling with their TV dials or their radio dials. Wait a minute. He just said, let's do what Sarah Palin said. I must have got the wrong station. No. Really? 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. The vice president was speaking on the air on national television this morning, and they had to interrupt his presentation or the coverage of his presentation. You can see the CNN International. It's on zillions of websites now. They had to interrupt it with breaking news. He was speaking of our gun laws and whatnot, with breaking news that there was a school shooting going on in Taft, California. And so the beat goes on. Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County, mcso.org, maricopacountysheriffsoffice.org is the website, and is back with us. Hey, Sheriff, welcome back to the program.
Nice talking to you again.
Thank you. You believe that you have a solution to these school shootings. What is it?
As far as I'm concerned, it's a stopgap solution until someone does something other than all this talk about it with all their task force and politics involved. So I decided to send out the posse. 20 years ago, I sent the posse out to the malls because of violence before I became sheriff, and for the last 19 years, there's been no violence at the malls during the holidays, so why not start using the posse to patrol around the schools?
Well, might that not be mixing up causation and correlation? I mean, there's been no violence in most malls in the last 20 years, nationwide.
Well, we've had violence at the malls. I'm not talking about everybody being shot, but we've had violent activity. That's why I called out the posse. And
so this school in California this morning, the early reports are that they had a full-time sheriff's deputy who was patrolling that school, and yet he wasn't able to stop a student from coming in with a concealed weapon and shooting another student, apparently in science class. Now, this is all early stuff. But how would your posse standing outside the school catch somebody carrying a concealed weapon into the school?
Well, maybe that should be the key. Catch them before they get into the school. So my theory is when you have marked cars around the schools, would my posse have an automatic weapons and semi-automatic weapons? Maybe somebody, the bad guy, may say, I'm not going near that school. So it is as a deterrence or prevention also.
Well, if he's suicidal, wouldn't he just shoot up the posse?
Shoot up the posse?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's going to work. You're not going to be able to shoot up any posse. If they do, we'll have enough ammunition and guns to retaliate.
I believe it's the Chicago Police Department defines an officer in a firefight situation successfully hitting a target 1 out of 5 times as, you know, good shooting, basically. It's the, not the phrase they use.
Pretty good shots. I even have a movie actor is part of my posse, Steven Seagal. He's probably the best shot there is in the country. He carries an automatic weapon.
You think so he can hit? He can hit more frequently than 1 out of 5 times in a high intensity firefight situation?
Well, you know, I don't know about those circumstances. Why are we picking out some selected situations?
Well, the reason I'm asking is because I'm wondering if those other 4 bullets are going to hit kids. It's like, do we really want firefights going on around our schools?
Well, do we want firefights going on anywhere on a street corner? Are you worried about my? I just had a deputy that was shot, and he's in critical condition. And I had another deputy a year before, right to the hour, that was killed with an automatic weapon.
Right. So these guys both had guns, and their guns didn't protect them.
60 shots to take them down. They didn't have automatic or semi-automatic weapons.
So
they're going to have it because I'm arming all my deputy sheriffs with automatic or semi-automatic weapons.
So these sheriffs of yours, sheriff's deputies of yours, were armed and their weapons did not protect them, right?
Well, I think if they had more firepower, the situation would have been somewhat differently. Why not arm my deputies with the same firepower that these bad guys have? Why should they be less?
Because if you look at, I mean, what you're describing is the situation basically in several third world countries. I was in Uganda at the end of the war with Idi Amin, and I understand Somalia is pretty much like that right now. What you saw was local militias that had gotten their hands on a whole lot of weaponry that, you know, were using that weaponry, and you know, people would use guns. They'd come in with semi-automatic weapons
weapons.
People would use automatic weapons, and they'd come in with rocket-propelled grenades.
Are you against guns?
I am suggesting to you that if we reduce the number, instead of amping up how well-armed we are, if we amped down how well-armed we are, we might have less of this violence. I'm not against guns.
That's not my opinion. There is a Second Amendment, we've had guns for hundreds of years.
Right.
And people have a right to purchase a weapon if they want to. The only thing I would say is if you do have a weapon, do a little training at the pistol range. My posse have been through the same requirements as regular deputies, over 100 hours of training and also refresher courses. A lot of them are ex-cops, military, doctors, lawyers.
What are they going to do when somebody shows up with a shoulder-fired rocket launcher?
Well, I do have a 50 caliber machine gun, too. I don't know if you like that.
That would take it out, probably. But it's like somebody would have to get to it and aim it and everything. And then, you know, then it's back like your two deputies that you just described who got shot. One was killed, even though they were armed.
So would you like me to arm them with knives? Is that...
No, I'm wondering why you're not calling for national regulations that say we're going to do with military weapons what we did with machine guns in the 30s.
You're asking me why? I'm a law enforcement guy.
Right.
I'm not a politician or just...
No, I get it.
Nothing gets done.
Okay, good point, man.
I'm talking like a law enforcement guy, which I am, 50 years.
Yeah.
Did work in Turkey. Involved in gun battles.
Mexico, I got it.
Involved in gun battles.
I got it. Sheriff, we're out of time. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sorry, he steps on us all the time. Sheriff Joe Arpaio, MCSO. Thank you, Sheriff,
for
dropping by. MCSO.org. Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. And Noel Flasterstein is with us. He is an attorney and host of The Gun Show, gunrightsforyou.com, and is the website. Noel, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Is it Flasterstein?
It is Flasterstein.
My apologies. There is this newspaper that, in fact, it's called the Journal News, who published the names of people who own guns in nearby, surrounding New York counties, New York State counties. And some people are quite upset about this. The newspaper is saying, wait a minute, these people want to be anonymous. They're asking for protection from the same jack. They wanted the government to enforce their anonymity. And they say they are asking for the same protection from the same jackbooted government thugs that they fear are going to grab their guns and against whom some have actually stockpiled guns. What do you say?
Well, clearly it's an intentional invasion of privacy, probably to upset and infuriate some gun owners. Me, personally, if any newspaper wants to publish my address as a gun owner, I'm fine with that, because I think the intent of the article may have been to harass these gun owners. It obviously, as I stated, invades their privacy. But I think the ultimate result is the non-gun owner is now subject to danger, because if I'm a would-be criminal, hey, here's my list of houses that I'm not going to rob or attempt to invade because I know they possess firearms.
But that's not what these people are saying. They're saying that because our home has been published, we're more likely to be robbed because people are going to want to steal our guns.
Who knows? I don't know what's...
Doesn't make sense to you. If somebody in your neighborhood had dynamite in their basement, would you want to know about it before you let your kids play there?
You know what? But that would be an illegal act on their part.
No, dynamite's legal in the United States. There are a lot of applications and uses for it. They're typically rural and agricultural or industrial, but there's a lot of people who legally own dynamite. Wouldn't you want to know if somebody in your neighborhood had dynamite in their house?
Yeah, I think I would, but at the same time...
So why not a gun?
You know, That's the individual's privacy, and this article was intentionally done to invade that privacy. Now, me, I'm a parent. I have firearms, and you know what? When people bring their kids over, I let them know I have a firearm just so they're aware, and I put it away. And sometimes I even sit down with the kids, and I say, hey, that's my firearm. You don't touch it. You see that? You tell your parents, you come get an adult. And then the next thing I might tell them is, okay, now can you hand me my gun? And then sometimes they go for it and I yell at them. And then sometimes they don't. And they said, no, you told me not to touch it.
So I'm curious, when you were a kid, did your father or any relative have a stash of Playboy magazines around that they didn't want you to get into?
Yes. And then
did you successfully get into them?
When you were caught, you were punished early. Of course.
I think this is a universal male experience, nowadays in the age of internet pornography, it probably isn't so much a universal male experience. But, just because an adult says don't do it, don't touch it, don't go there, not only is that not going to prevent a kid from getting it, but it seems to me like that's going to make them think, okay, as soon as Noel has gone off to the 7-Eleven, we're going to open that box and pull that thing out and see how it works.
But I've never heard of a child injuring himself or another with a Playboy magazine. Obviously, with the firearms, we're talking about
500 a year, over one a day. Children kill other children by accident with firearms in their home or a neighbor's home. 500 times a year in the United States.
Where are you getting that stat? Killed and injured or killed?
Killed. There's tens of thousands of shootings, but 500 deaths a year. This is from the Centers for Disease Control.
For children, are we talking ages 1 to 10?
I'm talking about minors. I'm talking about presumably people under 18. The CDC is calling them children. I'm assuming that means that they're not a voting age.
Now you got that gang factor of 12 to 17 who's actually selling drugs and carrying a weapon, getting shot at by other gang members. I'd like to know how many 1 to 10-year-olds, or has anybody, when do you separate out the gang factor? Because a lot of gang members, and I would say probably most of them, are minors.
This statistic already has had the gang factor separated out of it, because these 500 deaths a year are children who are not engaged in criminal activity. These are considered accidental deaths, 100% of them. It happens about once a day in the United States. A kid finds a gun, points it at another kid, or points it at themselves, not realizing it's loaded, not realizing how it works, and the thing discharges, and somebody dies.
Well, I think if you look at the FBI criminal statistics,
the FBI stats show 11,000 roughly gun deaths a year in the United States, and well over 100,000 shootings. And of those gun deaths, more than half of them are suicides. It's over 11,000 gun homicides, and there's about 20,000 gun suicides a year. I'm sure you know these numbers. I mean, this is your business.
Well, you're talking one thing when actually what I meant to refer to was the Center for Disease Control.
Right.
And I think if you look at their statistics, they're not going to say what you represent, which there are 500 deaths a day. A year. When you look at the Centers for Disease Control, and anybody can go to their website and they got the statistics, you got to spend a few minutes to learn how to navigate it. You'll see that children are more endangered by a swimming pool. They're more endangered riding a car. I mean, how many children died from a car?
Lots of them. Lots of kids die in car accidents. And that's the trade-off that we've made in our societies. We've said, we really need to have cars. And so let's start making them safer. And the number of children who die in car accidents as a percentage of our population today is much lower than it was in 1974 when Ralph Nader first started yelling about seatbelts and collapsible steering wheels. In fact, it has declined pretty much every year since we have been making safer and safer cars. I'm not seeing the same technological improvements over the last 30 years in firearms.
And you
and I both know that the stuff is out there. It's, trigger locks are, it would not be a big deal to simply require guns to be sold, with a trigger lock attached to them or sold, in a way and manufactured in a way that they're functionally disabled until somebody who really knows what they're doing enables them.
Trigger locks are, as far as I'm concerned, I don't put a trigger lock on any of my firearms in my home. In fact, when I purchase a new firearm, one of the first things I get away or throw away is the trigger lock.
Well, I'd say your kids are at terrible risk, and so are the friends of your kids.
No, they're not in terrible risk because things that I know that they can get access to, I put in a safe that is locked and secured that they can't gain access
to. Then what good do those weapons do you?
Well, because I have a sidearm by my pillow, which, you know, they want to put that in paper, they can go ahead and, you know, they can try to steal my guns, but at least I'll have a chance in protecting myself. You know, I'm sorry that children die, and I'm sorry that the things happened that did happen in Newtown, Connecticut, Aurora, and all these other places, which are gun-free zones. I'm sorry that these things happen, but I am not going to give up my right to keep and bear arms. I'm not going to give up my right to protect myself. Just because there are idiots out there that don't properly secure their weapons and people get injured. At the same time, I personally do not drink. Alcohol does not mix well with me. Should I make it that everybody that wants to
I'm not suggesting you should give up your weapons. I never said that. I think that we should have a national conversation about this. It seems to me like this straw man, this false polarity, this, you know, government's going to come take your guns or we're going to get rid of all of them. I mean, you know, nobody's saying that. No, seriously, nobody's saying that. But, you know, you brought up cars, the number of kids who die from cars, and you're absolutely right. And so what did we do about that? We said if you own a car, that car has to be registered in a way that we can track that car from sale, from person to person, from the time that car is manufactured until that car is ultimately disposed of. We track it because it's capable of causing death. And the person who uses the car has to prove proficiency with using that car with a motor vehicle license. They have to demonstrate that. And they and the car have to be insured. What's wrong with doing the same thing for weapons?
First of all, we don't have a constitutional right to operate an automobile or be issued a license. Okay, first of all, let me just throw that out there. Second, I agree with you about the whole gun registration idea. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I'm an attorney. What do I care if the police or the state knows that I have firearms and I've been vetted and properly trained and this and that? I have no problem with that whatsoever. But I do recognize and I understand why the NRA fights that and other pro-gun organizations fight gun registration acts tooth and nail because prior to the Nazis coming into power, the Weimar Republic required all of its citizens to register their firearms.
Not true. It was part of the Treaty of Versailles. It was the other nations around Germany that required Germans to do that. And when Hitler came to power, he relaxed the gun laws in Germany. But that had nothing to do with the Holocaust, and it diminishes the Holocaust, and it's an absurd argument.
No, it's not, because Hitler went to those roles and disarmed all of his enemies, and one of the first things he did is
before you talk about this on national radio, you really should read History of Germany. Actually, Daily Kos, I'm pretty sure, .com today has and if it's not Daily Kos, it's over democraticunderground.com. You know, a great piece by the Rude Pundit, actually, if you just Google the Rude Pundit, great piece where he digs through all this German history and dissects it. It's a non-argument. If you think that the government is going to come take your guns, you're never going to have enough guns, Noel. You're going to have drones.
They're not going to take my guns.
Then why are you bringing up Germany?
I'm relying on Stephen C. Halbrook, who wrote an article about
not. Yeah. Well, it. Check it out. Noel Flasterstein. Thank you, Noel, for being with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I still don't get it. It's like the argument always comes back to the Nazis or the government, and yet how are you going to take on the government with an AR-15? Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, and it's just remarkable. I gotta find this thing. This was a big deal. It's not there, and it's not here. The here it is, right here. UC Davis Law Review. This is by Carl T. Bogus. Yes, that's really his name, Dr. Bogus, B-O-G-U-S, a real professor. And he's talking about the Second Amendment. He says, the Second Amendment was not enacted to provide a check on government tyranny. Rather, it was written to assure the southern states that Congress would not undermine the slave system by using its newly acquired constitutional authority over the militia. This was in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, that the federal government is the ultimate regulator of the militia. That Congress would not undermine the slave system by using its newly acquired constitutional authority over the militia to disarm the state militias and thereby destroy the South's principal instrument of slave control. In effect, the Second Amendment supplemented the slavery compromise made by the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia and obliquely codified in other constitutional provisions. Fascinating. The Second Amendment was actually put in there so that the slave states could make sure that their militias would never be disarmed. And thus they would not, you know, therefore they could raise an army and have the Confederacy. And, well, you could argue that that actually is, well, okay, so we can have an insurrection. Or at least we did. And look how well that worked out. I mean, a lot of people died and we ended up right back where we started. This is why I just, you know, the inanity and insanity of saying that, you know, we've got to have guns to protect ourselves and the gun, it strikes me so tragic. Greg in Circle Pines, Minnesota, listening on AM 950 in Minneapolis. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A couple things. I want to thank you for having me on today. And there's so many things I disagree with you, but I want to make this point, and that is a ban on an inanimate object really doesn't help anything. What we need to do is address the problem that is mental health.
Wait a minute. We have banned, you know, ownership of plutonium, and there's not much of that around. We've banned mercury. I mean, it used to be a problem. I mean, the old phrase "mad as a hatter." People went literally insane from handling mercury. It's now pretty hard to get. It's not in our thermometers anymore. We solved that problem. It looks like there's a remarkable piece on Alternet.com right now. Talking about how as the amount of lead in our environment, we banned lead, as the amount of lead in our paint and in our gasoline went down, so did violence in our cities. Absolute correlation, state by state, county by county, city by city, and nation by nation. There's a 20-year lag time, but there's an absolute correlation. So banning things actually does work.
Well, banning things may work, but the two things that you quoted, lead and mercury, both contributed to mental health. And maybe with the lead going down, which was a definite correlation with mental disease, maybe that might be the problem where violence has gone down.
Well, there appears to be that correlation, but are you suggesting that we shouldn't ban semi-automatic assault weapons or automatic assault weapons or full automatic assault weapons or shoulder-to-fired rocket launchers? I mean, where do we draw the line?
I am not. I think the line has already been drawn. Fully automatic weapons are banned, as you pointed out earlier in the show, that was done in the 1930s. And just I have no disagreement with that whatsoever. A simple sidelight here, though, is that criminals still use them today, even though they are fully illegal. Also, shoulder-fired rockets, of course not. What we have, and the difference between an AR-15 and a Winchester semi-automatic, and I'll use Remington because I know for sure, model 17600, a hunting rifle, is mechanically, there is no difference.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you draw the line? That's the thing. If you want to draw the line to high capacity magazines, that's reasonable.
Yeah, well, I think that's a reasonable place to draw the line. My position on this is really simple and straightforward. I think that if somebody wants to have first of all, that weapons that are typically used on the battlefield have no place in civilian life. That, you know, if somebody wants to have a hunting weapon, a hunting rifle, and I would love to see, you know, some of the conservation organizations that are pro-hunter get involved in defining what is a sportsman-like weapon and what is stupid. You know, I mean, going out and hunting deer with a 50-shot clip is stupid. I hope you agree.
I agree with you.
I mean, I wouldn't want to be in the woods with that guy, and I don't think you would either. And obviously, neither would the deer. But
if I can't put the deer down in 3 shots, I shouldn't be out in the woods.
Absolutely. So let's say that, you know, ultimately, somebody's going to have to come up with a definition of what's an appropriate weapon for hunting, And I would leave that to the hunters. You know, there are organized hunters out there, not the National Rifle Association. I mean, that's a trade group, a front group for the weapons manufacturers, but, you know, real hunting organizations. Let's define what's appropriate hunting weapons, and let's define what's appropriate target practice weapons. And some of those are going to have to be confined to target ranges where you rent them rather than own them, or you can own them, but you can't take them home. And others you can take home. And let's just do three simple things, the exact same things we do with automobiles. Let's register the weapon. Let's, you know, from the time of manufacture until the time of destruction, let's register it and let's insure it. And let's certify that the owner is actually competent to use it and is also insured. Three simple things.
I have no problem with a competency test, but getting back to what is a sporting weapon and what is a military weapon, the similarity between
I got your point. You can repeatedly pull the trigger and repeatedly expel bullets, but you made the point. You added to that, you know, how many rounds are you going to have in that weapon? And I think that that's an important distinction.
Right. That would be a distinction. What I'm just saying is that what most people think of as an assault weapon, an AR-15 that you can buy at your local gun store, is it looks like.
But you can't buy a 50-shot clip for your Remington, can you?
No.
Okay, so that's the big difference between that and the AR-15, is that you can buy, you know, 50-shot, 100, you can buy a 100-shot drum for an AR-15, and you can't for your Remington hunting rifle, and that's what makes it a hunting rifle. Greg, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. What if everything you know about Newtown and Sandy Hook is wrong? I mean, quite literally. What if everything you know about it is wrong? Dr. James Tracy is with us. He is a professor of media history and analysis, political economy of communication. His website is memoryholeblog.com, and a professor at the school that one of our associate producers, Danielle, is a graduate of. She mentioned Florida Atlantic University. Professor Davis, Tracy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's very good to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. I shouldn't try to read and talk at the same time. I'm sorry, my tongue and brain get totally confused. I understand that I've seen several different media accounts of this, and some of them conflict, and that's why I wanted to get it right from you, that, you have suggested that at Sandy Hook in Newtown, this horrible school shooting, that there were multiple shooters. Let me just run through my list here, and then you can tell me where I'm right and where I'm wrong and you know, what your take is on this. A, that there were multiple shooters. B, that the government spirited a couple of them away. C, that somehow the Obama administration did this. It was a false flag operation in order, presumably, to provoke a gun control response. And D, that this is one of many like this, that the same thing happened in the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, that the same thing happened with the JFK assassination, that the same thing happened with 9/11. The list goes on and on and on. And finally, D or E, wherever I am, that this is what you teach at the college. What of that is accurate?
Well, I don't know where actually to begin, but I guess I could begin with the simple things first. That is one of the things that I teach at the college. I teach classes on journalism and media history and analysis and criticism and so forth. And we look at current events and historical events and the extent to which things might have been missed. One of the things I incorporate, for example, in my classes is Project Censored. I'm an affiliate. This past year, the Censored Yearbook, three of my students did stories that appeared in the top 25. The culture of conspiracy class that is on, quote-unquote, conspiracy theories, it's a little bit more detailed than that, is really a matter of looking at historical events in greater detail and attempting to come to terms with those and trying to find out what perhaps historians and the media.
So, yeah, for example, most Americans think that, you know, this one guy shot Abraham Lincoln and that was the end of that. But there was actually a real conspiracy. The conspirators were actually found and hanged, and somehow we don't talk about that. We don't much know about that.
Exactly.
So
I know that you're.
What's the deal with Sandy Hook?
Well, there is a good deal of conflicting news coverage, and I didn't begin looking at this until almost a week after it actually took place. And when I began to look at news footage and read articles and so forth, there was just a lot of material that didn't really fit. The storyline was changing constantly as a result of pronouncements from authorities and things of the like. So,
but why would you not expect that to happen? I mean, this was a wild, violent, internationally being viewed situation where you've got a whole bunch of media people who are all. I mean, there's millions and millions, hundreds probably of millions of dollars was made in terms of, you know, the media coverage of Sandy Hook. And so everybody wanted to get the first story first, and you would expect a lot of people to get it wrong.
Oh, that's absolutely true. That's one of the reasons that I created a timeline in an effort to really trace the narrative from prior to the event right through up until just the past week or so.
Right.
And there's still a lot of information that is somewhat conflicting. And some things, Tom, that actually just went down the memory hole, so to speak, in terms of aerial footage taken by the Associated Press of additional shooter suspects. We don't know for certain whether or not they were involved in the event, but here you have one of the worst school shootings in modern history, one of the worst mass shootings, and these individuals are ferreted away and we don't hear from them.
Well,
again.
My understanding is they were teachers fleeing the scene.
Well, I'm not sure if that's the case. Now, I believe that there's one individual who may have been a parent who was prone down in the parking lot, but then there are two other individuals that are up in the woods. At least one individual who's taken away in a police car. He has military. He has camo pants on and a black top. So you know, it would. I think that in order to put things at ease. The law enforcement authorities would come out and say that this individual, or you know, was involved, and or rather, excuse me, was at the scene, was in no way involved, and put it to rest.
So, do you actually think that Sandy Hook was part of a? It was not just a single deranged kid with his mom's guns. That it was part of something larger, and that it was. Actually, you know, promoted by or at the very least covered up by the Obama administration? Or are you putting that forward as a hypothesis for your class let's take this, you know, what's the Latin phrase, ad certium ad reductio? You know, let's reduce this to push this to the farthest absurd extreme and see if it holds up.
Right. Well, it's nothing that I've examined in the class. This is something that my blog is it does inform my academic work, but at the same time, it's something that I do as something of a journalistic endeavor.
So do you think that the Obama administration killed those kids?
I think that there's too little information that's actually known at this point to draw any specific conclusions. And my primary reasons for writing the pieces were to ask questions. What's going on here and what are we missing and why are the media presenting a particular almost kind of choreographed storyline? And there are a lot of things that are simply not addressed.
But as you know, as a professor of journalism, you know that asking questions implicitly makes statements. I mean, and it doesn't even need to be, you know, the old Richard Nixon, are you still beating your wife kind of question. It can be, you know, how, you know, I mean, just even raising the question, you know, even saying, well, there's no evidence that the Obama administration wasn't behind this, or maybe there is evidence that they were. I mean, that seems to me like dancing on the wildest edge of this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, I think that is one of the ways in which, the major way in which the media has attempted to construe this. Call me a conspiracy theorist, a nutty professor who's got silly questions, and we shouldn't, you know, really pay any attention to him. And he is being, being cruel to the survivors, the victims, and what have
you. But you see this not only at Sandy Hook. I mean, you see this at Columbine. You see this at most of the major tragedies in the United States. You know, from reading your blog.
I've not looked at Columbine, but certainly 9/11 and Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City,
and the John Kennedy, the assassination of JFK and RFK, the fairly well-known political assassinations of the 1960s. The two most prominent black leaders, Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X and the Kennedys. I certainly think there are a lot of unanswered questions there. In some cases, the evidence is overwhelming that there was a conspiracy to eliminate those individuals.
Well, Congress concluded there was a conspiracy to kill Jack Kennedy. The question is, you know, who was involved in that conspiracy? But to Sandy Hook, what's it going to take to satisfy you? We just have about a half a minute left here. I'm sorry.
To satisfy me? Well, again, I'm simply raising questions, and I believe that the media failed us at Sandy Hook, and this needs to be revisited.
You're coming in by Skype, and it's breaking up as soon as we start to drop the music on top of it. I'm sorry. We're gonna have to wrap it up. Dr. James Tracy, you can read all about it over at memoryholeblog.com. Thank you, Doctor, Professor, for being with us today.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Wow. So the government killed kids at Sandy Hook to what? Get us to do away with our guns? Really? Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. You know, I think that there, in a way, it's a healthy thing, and in a way, it's an unhealthy thing. And I say that as a guy who's helped write two books on the Kennedy assassination, and one of them gets into some considerable detail in the Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy assassinations as well, and Watergate, which didn't involve any assassinations, but, you know, the crimes thereof. I think in a way, it's healthy that we have skeptics, that we be skeptical. On the other hand, I think it's unhealthy that the nature of our skepticism is always to point to public institutions. And it causes us to miss what really happened. I mean, in the research, for example, that Lamar Waldron and I did, which NBC made into an hour-long movie, and Leo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro are going to make into a feature film this year, we found, and I think, you know, pretty conclusively, that the mob killed Kennedy, Jack Kennedy anyway, and probably Bobby. But because there was this instant, and this is how mob hits are done, is, you know, loud and in public, right? I mean, if think about it, if the CIA wanted to take out Kennedy, all they'd have to do is slip something in his cocktail or you know, catch him with the wrong woman at the wrong time and make it very public. I mean, there's a lot of ways that they could have taken him down. But, you know, not to argue the Kennedy assassination, but the point is that because there is this element in American society that immediately says, nah, it's got to be the government, we kind of immediately go there. I think we might miss a lot. I don't know. Just a thought. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to Sirius Radio. What's up?
Yeah, if I called in about economics, before I get to that, my father, when he was 7 years old, took a rifle to school, and he did get in trouble when it took him 20 rounds to kill a single squirrel on his way home, but he had that gun to protect his little brother and sister.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so, I mean, I know it's a different time and everything, but when I was in high school, I was issued an M1 Garand by my high school. We did target practice. We did war games. And that kind of stuff in high school. We had a rifle team. It was a less violent time than what we're experiencing now.
I agree. Okay. But those rifles were not You know, they were not high powered. They, you know, you could argue we didn't have movies that glorified, you know, mass killing. We didn't have, you know, Pulp Fiction,
you know,
kind of movies.
I went to see Bonnie and Clyde. That was pretty violent. And the M1 Garand is more powerful than an AR-15.
Huh.
More accurate, more lethal.
Huh.
And we were handed it out. They were handed it to us with firing pins installed and everything. So it was like
Yeah. A lot of weapons came back with the GIs coming back from World War II too. But
correct.
But you wanted to call about wealth.
Yes, you and I are reaching a point where you as a liberal and I as a conservative are getting to the point where we're starting to agree.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But your point about the concentration of wealth, I think there's a free market solution. I think we've talked about it before as far as this wealth tax idea.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we should have each congressional district identify that level, which is poverty. And the welfare handouts should be gauged by the truly needy in each congressional district and have a community, board or something like that determine who is the needy and who are the needy. Oh, sorry about that. And, do it that way. Also, each congressional district, there should be something, I guess, called a touchdown amount. I'll give you a good example is like Nancy Pelosi has $50 million.
Hmm.
And the touchdown amount for Nancy Pelosi theoretically would be about $10 million. Above that amount, either 1% wealth tax would come out of her pot, or
every year
she could basically purchase 49% of any business she would want to. That would generate a lot of people to decide where Nancy Pelosi is going to invest her money to avoid the tax.
Yeah, the idea of a wealth tax is not new or unique. Thomas Jefferson suggested it. Desuet de Tracy was a French economist. Jefferson, while he was president, actually translated Tracy's work from French into English for his friend the Marquis de Lafayette. And sent him letters begging him not to let anybody know that he was the translator because it would reflect, it would be a very political event because Napoleon was very, very upset about this. And, but there are a number of European countries and countries around the world that have wealth taxes, 1% of your wealth every year, or a fraction of a percentage of your wealth every year. But Jefferson, in a way he was a liberal, in a way he was a conservative. He's kind of the prototype of both in America. Suggested that if wealth becomes so great that it threatens democracy, that it threatens the state, that it should be reduced, and by taxation. So
well, the irony, and to bring it back to today, is in 4 years, the amount of money paid out to welfare recipients has effectively been reduced by 50% because of taking two commodities, ink and paper, combining them into the form of a United States dollar, and destroying the value of both. We've lost 50% of the value of the wealth in this country. The only people who are happy about that have got huge stores of gold, I guess, like Mitt Romney and George Soros.
Yeah.
So they're happy.
Well, and
welfare, people on welfare are basically. This is a surprise. It hardly ever happens in history, let's say the last 10,000 years. The people who really need the money, who really need the help, are basically being screwed again.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree. Very interesting. Steve, thank you very much for the call. And conservatives and liberals starting to agree. Scary times we live in. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Do you think there's even a remote possibility that what we know about Newtown, Sandy Hook, is wrong? I frankly don't. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Your media support group for We the People, Douglas in Scottsdale, Tennessee. Hey, Douglas. You keep your guns on on the kitchen table?
Throughout all this, I haven't heard anybody say gun control starts in the home. You know, if you have your guns on the table and trying to teach your children not to fool with them, it didn't seem like the way that last man you had with the, you know, through the journal, firearms or whatever. Your guns need to be put away. They need to be out of sight, out of mind. It's not something you have on the table. Gun control starts in the home.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I don't disagree with teaching your children an appropriate way. If you're going to have firearms in the home, you certainly want to teach firearm safety. It makes perfect sense. The question is, do you really need to have firearms in the home? And you know, some people think they do, and I'm not about to say that they can't have them. I'm just saying we all need to think about it seriously. Damien wants to tell us a story about a woman who had a gun in her home and was grateful for it. Damien, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom? No, maybe I caught your show late, but I did hear you say, you know, you just can't understand how people can justify gun ownership for home protection. I mean,
no, you didn't hear me say that. You did not hear me say that. Well, what you heard me say was that these gun owners who have been identified and are yelling, you know, we don't want anybody to know that we have a gun, are the same people who have bumper stickers on the back of their car that says protected by Smith & Wesson. You can't have it both ways.
Right.
You know, either you think that your gun is going to protect you or you think it won't. And you can't claim both simultaneously.
Well, I'll give you, look, I'm a gun owner and I do believe in background checks, but I just want your opinion on this. Number one, yes, there is that story of the woman in Atlanta. She had called her husband and said that someone was trying to break into the home. She had two small children with her. The husband told her to take out the gun. It was a revolver. Go into the crawl space. So she didn't want to even confront this person. He was rummaging through the home. She heard him. Then he ultimately found his way to her and the children. She shot the man multiple times. He lived. But, I mean, I think, in my opinion, if this woman did not have access to a weapon, she may very well have been raped and murdered, and the children would have been killed. So I think
I'm not saying that she shouldn't have had access to the weapon. Let me be very clear about this. I think that we need to define what are military weapons and what are sporting and self-defense weapons. And the military weapons need to stay with the military, and the sporting and self-defense and target practice weapons are available to the civilian population. B, if you're going to have a weapon, I think it should be registered, and its serial number should be registered, and it should be, you know, just like a car. You register a car. It should be insured, and there should be liability insurance. So if you accidentally kill the kid next door or wound him so he's, you know, stuck in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, your insurance will pay to take care of him for the rest of his life. Because more people are wounded or commit suicide with guns than are rescued or shot in self-defense with guns. And see that if you are going to own a gun, you should take some sort of training. And here's a great opportunity for the NRA. I actually went through a course that was co-sponsored by the NRA in gun safety. They do a pretty good job of this stuff. So the people should demonstrate their proficiency and they should get licensed. So it's just like with cars. You have a license. You prove that you know how to operate the thing because it's something that can kill people. You have insurance because it's something that can kill people or maim people, and it is registered. This seems to me like real common sense stuff.
I agree. I just want your opinion on this, seriously. I have a friend of mine. He's an NRA member. When I tell him that in New York State where I live, where you purchase a gun, I mean, it's a federal law from what I understand, they have to do a background check on you. They have to register the weapon.
Right.
Now, his argument is this, and I want your opinion on this, that he does not want the government to know he has a weapon because the purpose is that if he has a gun and the government is becoming tyrannical, he does not want – what's the first thing the government's going to do? They're going to go to a registry and say, okay, we need to go confiscate these people's guns. And he always
uses – No, it's not. That's not the first thing the government's going to do.
Hitler took guns away.
No, it's actually that's not true. Two things.
I know.
Let's just go through this really, really, really quickly here, okay? you've seen enough TV to, you know, even if it's just, you know, video of the Republican National Convention to know what a, you know, how militarized our police are these days. Do you really think that, you know, one guy with a whole pile of weapons or even a whole bunch of people in a house with a whole pile of weapons like David Koresh tried to do down in Waco are going to successfully take on our government? Any of our governments?
I don't, but what they're saying is that this is the argument. That
no, I know the argument. The government is tyrannical. Now, first of all, who defines tyrannical? But nonetheless, the government's tyrannical. They're going to come and take your gun. No, the government is going to, they're not going to just take your gun. They're going to take you. And they're going to put you in jail, or they're going to put you in some concentration camp, and they're going to haul you off to death camps and kill you. And that was the experience of people in Nazi Germany. That's not America. And if it ever were America, I'm telling you, having a gun in your home is not going to stop it. It just speeds up the rate of the massacre.
His argument is, how do you prevent it ever becoming a Nazi Germany?
You participate in politics. The Nazis took over Germany by taking over the political process. They did it in the ballot box.
Well, let me ask you then. His latest thing is this. If you look at Syria, he says the people in Syria wish they had a Second Amendment. That's his biggest thing, because the Assad would be taken out.
That is the exact perfect example of where that argument falls apart, Damien. Look at the difference between Syria and I'm going to do that right now. Look at the difference between Syria and Egypt. You have two Middle Eastern countries, very similar cultures, same language, largely the same religions, you know, so a lot in common, okay? So that we can take out a lot of variables. Very different responses to a tyrannical government. In Egypt, people stood up and came to Tahrir Square every single day, thousands, tens of thousands of people, women pushing children in baby carriages, young people, students, none of them had weapons. The military shot at them a couple of times, and the people in Tahrir Square said, do not bring weapons, do not shoot back. A number of people died, 20, 30, 40, 50, I don't know the number, it was a relatively small number, but a number of people were actually killed by the government. And that strengthened the revolution, because it was a peaceful, nonviolent revolution. Those people stood, and they had right on their side, because they were not shooting back at the government, just like Martin Luther King had right on his side. And so that nonviolent movement, in a matter of just a few weeks, or maybe month or so, was able to bring down Hosni Mubarak. Egypt, the entire Egyptian government, which was the largest and one of the richest and most powerful governments, and numerically certainly the largest, in the entire Middle East, fell because of a nonviolent revolution. Now, on the other hand, in Syria, Bashar al-Assad goes out and he says, I mix up my Bashirs. I think Bashar al-Assad is the head of Sudan, but you know, whatever his name. Bashar says, people say we're going to have an uprising. We're going to do like Egypt did. They show up in the streets. And so the government shoots at them. Now, if those people had stood like they did in Egypt and said, okay, take your best shot. 10,000 of us are going to come tomorrow. You kill 10,000 of us, 20,000 of us are going to come tomorrow. I don't think probably more than a few hundred people would have died before that government fell, just like in Egypt. But instead, the United Nations told us last week that over 60,000 people have died so far in Syria. Why? Because all over Syria you have these armed militias. You have the equivalent of the Michigan militia and the Georgia militia. You got these groups of people who have lots and lots of weapons. And they're saying to the government, we're going to take you out with an AK-47. And the government says, fine, we're going to bring in a fighter jet, drop a bomb on your head.
You got a point, but I guess they're saying is that the first thing that a Stalin or a Hitler would do is to disarm.
But they're wrong.
Citizens.
The first thing that Hitler did is he got all the people with him, or the majority of the people, the Christian majority in Germany, with him. Hitler was the most popular politician, arguably, in the history of Europe. He was on the cover of Time magazine here in the United States twice in the 1930s as Man of the Year. I mean, Lindbergh, you know, the famous aviator was out there saying, oh, you guys are misunderstanding Hitler. You know, this was in the mid-30s, of course, before, you know, we went to war with him. But he was incredibly popular. He used politics to seize power. If you're concerned about your government going crazy, you need to get involved in your government. You need to become your government. The last thing you need to do is stock up on weapons, because if your government ever does go crazy, your weapons are going to be useless. You cannot take on.
I mean, their argument is, if you look at the people in Vietnam, they stood up to America and such, and the people fought back for their homeland. That's
absolutely true. That is absolutely true, Damien. And they were fighting off foreigners, just like we fought off the British, who were foreigners. But right. You know, Jefferson was like five generations in North America. Most of the people who were involved in the Revolution, multiple generations in this country, they thought of themselves as Americans, not as British subjects. They fought off foreigners. But when you look at violent revolutions within countries where people brought down their own government violently, there are two that come to mind immediately. The first is the French Revolution. What happened? The French Revolution led right to the terrors, the guillotine, lots and lots of people murdered. And then what came back? I mean, go see Les Mis. I strongly recommend you go see that movie, Les Mis. What came back was the kings. The revolution failed. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Let's rise up with violence. What do you get? You end up with a Stalin and a Lenin. You end up with a disaster. Violent revolution doesn't work. On the other hand, Mahatma Gandhi in India said, we're going to have a revolution nonviolently. Just like Martin Luther King here in the United States, we're going to have a revolution nonviolently. And what did he do? He overthrew the British. So, yeah, I think that, you know, overthrowing a foreign government, good idea, but indigenous, it doesn't work.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, people need to just think through the logic of this. If you're concerned about the government, become the government. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service for the news of the day, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat. You can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen Ratner. Hey, Ellen. Ellen, I understand that Joe Biden was on television, or was being, you know, filmed on television, shown live on television, discussing gun violence in the United States, and CNN International had to cut away to cover a school shooting in a little town in Southern California.
Why am I not surprised that this kind of thing is going on? What's fascinating is that the NRA today met with Vice President Biden, and then they, in a nastily, snarkily issued statement, said, we attended today's White House meeting to discuss how to keep our children safe, and we're prepared to have a meaningful conversation. And then it goes on and on. However, we were disappointed with how little this meeting had to do with keeping our children safe and how much it had to do with an agenda to attack the Second Amendment.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't have invited the NRA because it's just giving them a platform for, and you know, they're out there, you know, pumping publicity. They're raising money.
Freddie Eagle gun safety guy that right. They send into schools, believe it or not.
Yeah.
It's really quite astounding. The president will apparently get the report from the president vice president as early as Tuesday on gun violence.
Well, that'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. So what else
it'll
is going
on? It'll be very interesting. Now, more a little bit about this Reverend Giglio guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the president asked him to give a benediction or a prayer at the inauguration. He, because of his work in human trafficking, and he issued a statement today that said, speaking on this issue has not been in the range of my priorities during the past 15 years.
This issue being his trashing gays 15 years ago.
Right. Now, what's really fascinating about this is that he did not say that he disagreed with what he said 15 years ago.
He just said he's not saying it anymore.
Right. He said it hasn't been one of his priorities.
Right. Well, in that case, I think it's appropriate that he stepped down, and he has, hasn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
I mean, and it also looks like the White House didn't vet him appropriately, which is
right.
Shocking,
right.
Really, on that front.
Yeah,
I mean, they didn't look into some of that.
Sure.
Also, by the way, speaking back to the NRA, they claim they took in 100,000 new members since Sandy Hook from 4.1 to 4.2 million people.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, they look at all the publicity they've got.
Right. They've gotten a ton of publicity. Okay. Interesting, the White House has also been under some critique for their lack of diversity. Charlie Rangel, Congressman Rangel, was on television today saying that it's embarrassing as hell, to give a quote. He said, I kind of think there's no excuse for this in a second term. However, Eric Holder will be staying on.
Okay.
Now, there is quite a bit going on about the Hagel, the Hagel nomination from the Republicans. Rick Santorum, as if anybody's going to pay any attention to him, is supposedly leading the fight against Hagel. He served with him. However, 42 senators in the Senate have not served with him, but if you do the math, that's enough for confirmation in terms of the brotherhood, sisterhood of the Senate.
Unless there's a filibuster.
That's right. I mean, they could get through it somehow. I think.
Yeah, I think they will. I mean, it's the people who don't get confirmed by the Senate typically don't get confirmed because, you know, they've committed crimes and it came out that, you know, it's happened, I think, twice since the Eisenhower administration.
I can't imagine that they're not going to confirm him.
Yeah.
Also, Trent Franks, on the House side is going after him, but of course he doesn't have any confirmation. I mean,
he doesn't have any say in it. He's just grandstanding. What I'm wondering is what happened to Susan Rice? What happened to Susan Rice? Now this is state. We've been talking about defense, but back to state. Did she back out, or did Obama say the pressure from the Republicans is too great? They really want John Kerry out of the Senate and into the cabinet, and so we'll go along with it.
I think it's a little more complex than that. Don't forget that John Kerry wanted this job more than life itself. And he was the president's sort of debate partner to teach him how he thought Romney was going to respond. So he clearly had the president's ear, and he has wanted that. He's just wanted it desperately.
Right.
So it's hard to know whether the president picked up the phone and said to Susan Rice, it's over, or whether there was a lot, or whether that was motivated by the Republicans, or whether that was really motivated by wanting John Kerry in there. Hard to know.
Right. Okay. All right. What else?
I doubt whether she would have just gone on her own. I think she would have fought the fight knowing her personality.
Okay.
Also, there is now the Republicans are going completely nuts about Jack Lew. And in fact, Orrin Hatch is beginning to lead some of this saying, well, the president, while he congratulates him on the nomination, it is time to get the fiscal house in order. And of course, there's a whole lot of question as to whether there's going to be the house in order. And now, of course, the anti-Lew crowd is also going on the internet and putting out very out of context remark that he said to what's known as the Sperling Breakfast. It's a bunch of print reporters, mainly in Washington, saying there's no need to deal with Social Security. But again, completely out of context, one line, typical of how they do things.
Well, there isn't really a need to deal with Social Security. It's solvent for the next 24 years. We got plenty of time.
Oh, listen, they're just trying, they're using the scare tactics. Now, by the way, Representative Cummings and Henry Waxman released some documents today showing that Walmart's CEO was informed of the Mexican bribery allegation in 2005 and did not do anything about it. And they are hot to trot on this issue.
Well, that's interesting. We'll see how that plays out. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Check it out. Ellen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We will be back. And Lance Roberts is going to drop by, Chief Strategist with Street Talk Advisors. Yeah, we're going to talk about the debt ceiling. Why don't Republicans want to pay their bills?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you in our republic. By the way, it is flu season. This flu is particularly intense. Big story about it in the New York Times today. It's just spreading across the country like crazy. I know several people right now who are down with it. In fact, Jim, our video guy, is home. Hey, Jim, if you're watching, with the flu. Just a warning. If you go into a Red Lobster, Olive Garden, Capital Grill, any of the Darden restaurants, they don't pay their workers sick time. We do, but they don't. And so, you know, and not just those restaurants, any restaurant you walk into. You might want to just ask at the door when you walk in, do your employees get paid sick days? Because if they don't, the person making, handling, and serving your food may also be sneezing on it because they can't afford to take a day off because they're sick. Not a good thing. Anyhow, 1% of the cost, Nick Kristof points out today in the New York Times that 1% of the cost of our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq is enough money to end illiteracy across the entire planet, worldwide. 1%. And yet we put 100% of it, George W. Bush put 100% of it on the national credit card and made no provisions whatsoever to pay for it. A couple of trillion dollars. Part of that bill is now coming due. Congress authorizes expenditures. The White House doesn't have the power to do that. The White House, though, runs the Mint, or runs the Treasury Department. They have to pay the bills when they come due. And the Republicans are saying, yeah. We had these two wars. We had this massive tax cut, cost $1 trillion. You know, we had a nice little depression. It's costing $1 trillion. We had the Medicare Part D. You know, it was a $600 billion giveaway to the drug companies. We didn't make provisions to pay for any of them, and now, Mr. Obama, we're not going to let you pay for them because we're not going to raise the debt ceiling so that you can simply write the check to pay for the bills run up by Republicans. Are these people crazy? Lance Roberts is with us. He is the chief strategist of Street Talk Advisors. StreetTalkLive.com is the website. Lance, you've heard my argument. What am I missing here? Why do Republicans not want the administration to do what the law requires, the laws that they passed, what the Republicans in Congress, Republican president said, we're going to have all of these expenses and the next president is going to have to write the checks for him. Now you got the next president. He's got to write the checks. Why are they trying to stop him?
Well, there's two things that are going on here. And one, I wrote an article about this recently called The Need for the Debt Ceiling Debate. And you know, the important thing here is that you're absolutely right. There are some laws that are set into place that our Congress is supposed to operate on. The president's supposed to pass a budget every year. Congress is supposed
actually,
to
no, the president budget. Doesn't pass a budget. There is no provision. In fact, the Constitution is quite explicit. Article 1, Section 8, only Congress has the authority to pass budgets, to authorize funds or to raise taxes. The White House can propose it if they want. It's not in the Constitution. But, the White House can say, gee, this is what we would like, but they have no power.
But you're right. But the point here is that Congress is supposed to authorize the spending. Treasury issues the debt. But the problem is we haven't had a budget in 4 years.
We haven't functionally had a budget. You know, we've had maybe three or four of them in the last 30. I don't disagree that it would be nice to have a good conversation about a budget, but the fact of the matter is that every time somebody tries to have a conversation about it, Republicans filibuster it in the Senate.
That's right. And then this is the problem that we currently have going on. And now they're talking about these things, such as using the 14th Amendment to bypass the debt ceiling, issue a $1 trillion platinum coin to bypass the debt ceiling. The point here is that, you know, the elected officials that we have need to start acting like adults and do what they're supposed to do, which is clearly stated within our Constitution. And they're supposed to be following these very laws that have been passed to run our government on a fiscally responsible basis. This is why.
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that our government has to be fiscally responsible. When our country was founded, we were massively in debt.
Exactly.
To the French.
And the point here is that when the Constitution was written, remember, the people that wrote our Constitution came from a country that was fiscally bankrupt.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, they
the
did.
People who wrote our Constitution.
England blew themselves up.
No, wait a second, Lance. Go back and look at the history of the people who were at the Constitutional Convention. None of them had been in this country for less than two generations. Most of them, three, five, seven generations. These were Americans. These people did not think of themselves as Brits. That's why they fought a war against Great Britain.
But they
didn't come from a country.
Their history and their experience was based upon what they knew and witnessed from England. And England blew themselves up more than once. Look, the whole South Sea problem that occurred with the South Sea Corporation was the fact that the government of England, fighting the war with France, transferred the debt to a private corporation that shelved it off on individuals. It blew up massively.
Well, actually, you could argue, and I don't think we want to turn this into a debate about the South Sea bubble, but, you know, it was the Dutch tulip bubble all over again. That was a stock market bubble that crashed. You could argue that that was the failure of having a transparent and well-regulated stock market. More than anything else.
No, the whole
thing. It was a market in debt, but it was a market.
The South Sea Corporation took debt from England and converted it to annuities in order to free up England to continue to fight their fight with France.
No, I've got all that, but that's not what caused the South Sea bubble.
No, of course, it didn't. No,
it was speculators.
The problem, what we're talking about, is that it's the experience of the individuals that founded this country came from a country that had more than once bankrupted itself.
Well, or the banks had bankrupted it. This is why many of the founders wrote, Jefferson wrote that bankers are more to be feared than armies.
Well, sure, absolutely. But
what does that have to do with Republicans saying we are not going to pay the bills? I don't understand.
No, we will pay the bills. Let's clarify something very quickly. We will not default on our debt. We are a sovereign currency issuer in this country. We can print money to pay our bills. We will not default.
Then why are John Boehner and Mitch McConnell saying that they want to use the debt ceiling as leverage? You don't take a hostage unless you are fully willing to either kill or injure that hostage. Otherwise, there's no point.
Right. Look, we shut down the government more than once. In 1995 and 1996, under the Clinton administration, we shut down the government.
Yes and no.
We furloughed jobs. We
they did not. They did not default on our debt.
We laid off federal workers.
No, we did not default on our debt.
But we did not default on our debt.
It was called a government shutdown, but it wasn't. That was Newt Gingrich grandstanding, basically.
It doesn't matter.
And it was not using the debt ceiling to do it. This is a whole different animal, Lance, and you know it.
We have more than enough revenue coming in to pay our bills. It is the only reason that we'll default on our debt is if we choose to default on our debt. Period. End of story.
Well, if the Republicans refuse to raise the debt ceiling, we will default on our debt.
No, we won't. We will not default on our debt. We have the revenue.
You want to shut down the FAA?
Every month, because we're only talking about interest payments, right?
No, we're not. We're talking about the full cost of the government.
No, that's not true. That's not defaulting on our debt. Defaulting on our debt is when we don't pay, when one of our bonds come due, if we don't pay the principal and interest on our bonds, that's default.
Right.
Not paying a bill in terms of not paying our federal employees because they didn't, they showed up for work, or laying off federal workers for a month or 2 months or 3 months, that's not defaulting on our debt. Defaulting on our debt is when China shows up at our doorstep and says, here's my bond, it's due, pay me the principal and the interest.
Right.
That's a default.
Well, and it would more likely be the Bush family than China. I mean, more debt is held by Americans in America than is China. To your point, we passed that threshold a week and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We're doing, the Treasury Department right now is doing that dance where they're saying, to defense contractors, can you let us pay, net 60, maybe net 90 instead of net 30? Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're already doing that. And what's going to happen is they're going to run out of that breathing room in 6 or 8 weeks. And that's the point at which there's like nothing left. You've got a choice. Are you going to have the FAA or are you going to shut down the airports and pay the bondholders?
That's right.
I don't understand why you would defend Mitch McConnell.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not defending any of those of the people up in Congress. They're a bunch of babies. They're all arguing over an issue that shouldn't be argued over at all. They need to all start acting like adults. I am not defending any of them on this issue.
Okay. Lance, nice to talk to a rational conservative. Thank you. Lance is the chief strategist with Street Talk Advisors, StreetTalkLive.com. Check it out. Thank you, Lance.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back in just a moment. So I'm going to try this. Louise and I actually have a business meeting tonight after we get off the air, after the TV show, and at a restaurant here in town, and I'm going to call them when I get off the air, and I'm going to ask, do you give paid sick days off to your employees? Because I don't want to eat there if you don't. Because restaurants typically in the United States pay around $2.50 an hour, and the people work on tips. And what that means is if they don't get paid sick days, and it would have to be well paid. It would have to be paid well enough that it covers the cost of tips as well. If they don't get paid sick days, if they're sick, they're going to show up for work. And they're going to be bringing me my food. And I don't want that happening. So I'm curious if you have had the experience, and I'm guessing you haven't, because I haven't heard anybody else talking about this, and I just actually there's an ad, a phony Red Lobster Darden restaurant ad that I think the MoveOn.org people helped put together. I saw it over at Democratic Underground. And you know, where the employee is saying, "Oh, I love working at Red Lobster." It's true. And she, you know, through the whole ad, they have to keep redoing the take because she keeps sneezing on the food. And then they, at the very end, it says, "Did you know that workers at Red Lobster, Olive Garden, Capital Grill, and all Darden restaurants do not receive paid sick days? And since many of these restaurants also pay their servers as low as $2.13 an hour, most workers cannot afford to take a day off to protect their health and the health of customers." Speaking as a customer, I don't want to show up in a restaurant that doesn't offer paid sick days. So if you have the experience, give us a call. You know, later in the week, I'm guessing it's going to take a while for our listeners and our viewers to have had this experience of asking, you know, going to a restaurant, do y'all offer paid sick days? No, we don't. Okay, I'll see you later, because there's a flu epidemic going on right now, and I don't want to get it. Gary in Santa Maria, California. Hey, Gary, you want to talk about Taft, California?
Yes. This morning on HLN Network, a boy went into his high school and shot a student in his class with a shotgun and also hit his teacher. The boy's in critical condition at the hospital. The teacher was hit, but she's okay. Two other teachers went into the classroom and actually talked the boy down and got the gun, and he's arrested now.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, they had to interrupt Joe Biden's press comments about his meeting with the NRA on gun control to break to the story that in Taft, California, there was a school shooting. I find that so it's almost like it's God talking to us. You know, it's like the Republicans have their convention, and what shows up? A hurricane.
That's exactly why I wanted to call you.
Yeah. Okay.
So here, much about this.
It is so ironic. Gary, thank you very much for the call. Kevin, you think I'm all wrong about Syria. You're in Virginia Beach, Virginia, listening on Sirius XM. What's up?
Hey, Tom. With Syria, the demonstrations actually started out peaceful, but that's not what
they
my
did.
Call is
at. I agree.
About. Here's the thing, Tom. I don't necessarily disagree with you about your views on gun ownership, but I think one problem that we oftentimes overlook is the influx of these radical nationalists that are just growing in this country. And as a black man in the military with an interracial marriage, I've had some instances with radicalism, both from black radicals and white radicals. Mm-hmm. And the way I look at it, knowing the history of my ancestors in this country, the last thing I want to do is give up my Armalite rifle and be powerless against a group of crazies that come to my doorstep. Because I've had a group of crazies come to my doorstep.
I understand, and that's an argument I can't disagree with your argument. My argument, my disagreement is with people who say that they think that they're going to stop, the state police from hauling them out of their house. I mean, that didn't work out all that well for David Koresh.
And you know something, Tom? You know, when people think that the government is going to become tyrannical, they're really saying that the military is going to become tyrannical. And, you know, we swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution. That's the people, support and defend the people of this country.
Mm. We being
against
soldiers.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I could never imagine picking up my weapon against a bunch of innocent civilians.
Right.
And using it against a bunch of innocent civilians. Other people may not be like me, and I understand that. And that's the part of me that, I understand that some people are just crazy. They go out and do those stupid things. And, I can understand having a ban in place or even having no weapons available at all.
Right.
But having the history we have in this country, there's no way in hell that I would ever give up my Armalite rifle.
Yeah. Well, I'm not asking you to. And, you know, at the most, I'm saying that if you have a weapon, it should be registered just like your car is registered. And you should know how to use it. And you obviously do. And I, you know, I think that that's, you know, I have no disagreement with that as a fundamental right. And excellent point. Kevin, thank you for calling and making it. Chris in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hi, how you doing, Tom? I've worked in the restaurant industry for 10 years of my life, and not only do they not give you sick paid days off, but they don't give you any kind of holiday pay as well. You always have to work the holidays. Granted, that's part of being in the restaurant industry, but they also they take percentages of your tips, and they mostly base it on your sales. So if I sold $1,000, they would take about 5% of that. And
because they're assuming you're making 15 in tips, you mean? 15%?
They're assuming, yes. Yeah. So if someone tips you nothing, you still have to pay the house $20.
Wow.
And then they also, if you get paid tipped on credit cards,
right,
they take 5% of your credit card tip as well.
So they double
cover the cost.
They double ding you.
They
but
do.
Do you, are there restaurants that pay for sick days? I mean, maybe there just aren't any.
I've worked in probably 6 restaurants, and I've never had that happen.
Wow. I just can't imagine running a business. I mean, every business I've ever run, we've offered paid sick days. But beyond that, I can't imagine running a restaurant, you know, where you're handling people's food and not offering paid sick days. It just blows my mind. Chris, thank you for enlightening us. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now I'm getting really curious. I'm going to call a couple of restaurants tonight and just, you know, what's the deal? Do you offer sick days? And if you call any, let us know what happens. The bad and the very, very argusly ugly. The good. 5 Broken Cameras. Earlier today, the Oscar nominations were announced, and the documentary 5 Broken Cameras has been nominated for an award. The documentary is a deeply personal and firsthand account of nonviolent resistance in the village of Bilin, a West Bank village threatened by the spread of Israeli settlements. The documentary was filmed mostly by a Palestinian farmer. Besides being an excellent film, the documentary also preaches the same message that I say over and over again. Nonviolent resistance and revolution is the best way to accomplish change and accomplish democracy. The bad. Georgia State Representative Charles Gregory. To kick off the new session of the Georgia State Assembly, Gregory introduced a package of legislation aimed at weakening gun laws in the Peach State. Among the provisions of legislation is a provision that would let any college student with a permit carry a concealed weapon on campus. Gregory's introducing the measure even though Georgia University and security officials are opposed to it. The Indiana State Legislature is also considering a similar bill that would arm college students. Nothing says school safety like alcohol, parties, and a bunch of armed kids. And the very, very ugly, James Yeager. Yeager is the CEO of a Tennessee weapons company and tactical training company called Tactical Response. Yesterday, he posted a video on YouTube and Facebook in response to reports that President Obama could use executive action with minor gun control measures. Take a listen to Yeager's reaction.
That. I'm telling you that if that happens, it's going to spark a civil war, and I'll be glad to fire the first shot. I'm not putting up with it. You shouldn't put up with it. And I need all you patriots to start thinking about what you're going to do, load your damn mags, make sure your rifle's clean, pack a backpack with some food in it, and get ready to fight. I'm not putting up with this. I am not letting my country be ruled by a dictator. I'm not letting anybody take my guns. If it goes one inch further, I'm going to start killing people.
It's funny how gun nuts manage to inadvertently provide the best reasons for gun control when they're actually trying to argue against it. Threatening to kill people? Now that is very, very ugly. It's remarkable. This is the consequence of demagoguery, of using this very real issue. You know, let's have a rational discussion about the role of guns in our society. And frankly, my suggestion which is that we simply register guns like cars. We insure people like we do with cars, and we have driver's license, you know, gun licenses, proficiency, you know, check, and it doesn't need to even be, you know, periodic like it is with cars at a certain age. That it, for some reason, that's considered some kind of radical lefty position. Was it like, you know, when we put up the first stop sign, you know, 100 years ago, or however long ago it was that, you know, it was probably about 100 years ago when we first started developing, you know, okay, this red octagon means stop and orange light, you know, and lights and things. When we first came up with a stop sign, was that like the beginning of the descent into automobile tyranny when we were going to take away your cars? I don't get it. I just don't get it. Mike in Delano, Minnesota, listening on KTNF, Minnesota's Progressive Talk.
Thank you for taking my call once again. The good and the bad and the ugly is, I guess, the perfect lead into what my question or comment is. I like your opinion about something, and I'm sure you'll probably agree. Remember a couple of years ago, there was a young man out east, I believe it was, who was listening to Glenn Beck and believed the line about the government taking away his guns, and he actually, you know, stockpiled some and called 911 and shot a couple of police.
Yes.
And, you know, there's been instances of this happening, O'Reilly with Tiller, the baby killer, along with this national discussion about gun control. I think another discussion or something else needs to be looked at, and that's the role of the media, especially the right-wing media with Alex Jones and the other, you know, your listeners, and you know what I'm talking about, yeah. all the ideology and the rhetoric coming out of this discussion, the government taking away the guns. And what needs to be looked at is the media's role in this, because there's people losing their lives over things being said on the public airwaves about this gun control issue.
Right. I don't disagree.
What's your opinion about that?
I don't disagree. On the one hand, I would not and will not call for censorship in our media. I think that if somebody wants to go on the air and say that he's going to start effing killing people, and if Charlton Heston wants to say they're going to get my gun when they pry it from my cold dead fingers, that's fine. I mean, at least we know who they are and where they are and what their opinions are. I think it's dangerous. I think it's stupid. I think there is probably a point at which you're yelling fire in a crowded theater. You know, you've stepped over the line.
That's my point, is that there's a cause and effect. There can be an action to people's words can cause other people's actions.
Yeah.
And I think it's really kind of interesting that when the pundits I hear, bring up and argue the Second Amendment, and they're free under, they use the free speech, the First Amendment to justify what they can say, which is, of course, regulated. You can't just say anything over the airwaves.
Right.
But you know, the First Amendment can be regulated, but the Second Amendment can't. And I think
and the Second Amendment has the word regulated in it.
Right.
It doesn't say well regulated speech machine. but there is this well regulated militia. Now, it's an excellent point, Mike. And the one thing that comes to mind that probably more Americans need to know and don't is that the Rwandan genocide was tripped off by a talk radio host who went on the air and started yelling, you know, I forget who killed who. Was it Hutus or Tutsis? Who were the killers and the killees? Do you know? I don't remember. Shano doesn't remember. But whichever it was, he was one of the killer group, and he said, go out and start killing the killees. And literally, it was a talk radio show that you know, in the largest city in Rwanda that got this genocide started. And so, yeah, there is a point at which you could say it is yelling fire in a crowded theater. The best we can do right now is just call it out, show it for what it is, show the crazies for what they are, and perhaps use ridicule as a way of softening the blow. But Mike, excellent point. Thank you for the call. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that hospitals also don't necessarily have sick time either.
You're kidding!
No, particularly non-contract hospitals, they'll have paid time off, but they'll discourage people from taking it since they will, you know, essentially, you know, hire you as a full-time person, but if your patient census is low, they'll send you home, which is becoming more of a thing with the lesser reimbursement,
right,
or the, you know, that they can take advantage of you because this is a new economy and you're lucky to have a job and
right,
et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, people come in to hospitals sick. I see it all the time.
And you mean employees come into hospitals sick?
Yeah, employees come into hospitals. Yeah, well, people do too, but employees
yeah,
come into hospitals and they are sick, yes.
Incredible, incredible.
And, you know, it's, you know, obviously it's a whole population of people that have, you know, really compromised immune systems, but, you know, they might wear a mask or something, but this is just, you know, across the board. I think it's not just in restaurants, but in other areas.
It's absolutely bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. John, I want to get some more callers in here. Thank you for the call, though. I appreciate it. Thanks for the information. Harvey in Milledgeville, Georgia. I've been to Milledgeville. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
Very well, thank you. And I hope the same
to
you.
I just want to let you know that I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm proud of the way that you stand up to these people that come on every day talking about why they need to have these guns and debunking some of the theories they use for owning guns.
Well, thank you.
You know, I just want to say how proud I am of that, hearing you do that.
Thank you. That's very, very kind of you, Harvey, and thank you for the for your kind words and for the call. I appreciate it. Donald in Oak Brook, Illinois. Hey, Donald.
Yes, hi, Tam. That one gentleman that was calling that said something about he was like he's going to start shooting people. You know, it really kills me. These individuals that talk like that, these are the ones that can't wait to to find an opportunity to start shooting people. They use anything.
Right.
And the minute you start talking about gun regulations, they go into the Second Amendment hysteria and they start overreacting. They're like a little bunch of spoiled kids. That's what they remind.
Well, I think they're frightened people, Donald. I think they're genuinely frightened people, and that fear is being played out this way. And you know, they're probably frightened in many dimensions of their lives. Donald, I got to move along. I want to get some calls in here. Dave in Chicago. Hey, David, thanks for listening to WCPT. Hey. We have a minute to the break. It's all yours.
Hey, Tom, how you doing, buddy? I just want to make a point about the sick days with restaurant workers.
Mm-hmm.
My girlfriend, actually, she works at a rather high-end place in Chicago, and they're more than happy to give you sick days off whenever you need it. But she makes great money.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest point is they're a union where she works. So, you know, and they make such good money there that they're more than, you know, there's always somebody that's underneath them that works seniority wise.
Sure.
That are willing to just come in for them if they're sick, you know.
Yeah.
They're more than happy to, you know.
Well, and it just seems like, you know, if you're running a restaurant and you want your customers to be happy, one of the things you don't want them to do is get sick. And not only that, you don't want your employees to be sick. It takes a lot of people to run a restaurant, and a sickness can run through a company really fast. Especially
as food. If you're a server, walk up to a table sneezing and coughing, I mean,
yeah,
that's going to turn the payoff right there. So,
if I'm at that table, I'm out of that restaurant. I'll tell you. Dave, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We will be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, your media support group for we the people. The somebody called and asked about that professor. It was Carl T. Bogus, B-O-G-U-S, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment, who said it was... I'll tell you right after. Peace.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Who said essentially it was the southern states that got the Second Amendment in there because they wanted to be able to carry weapons to keep their slaves in line. Apparently slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Jason in Decatur, Alabama. Excuse me. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, I was just wanting to comment on an earlier caller had called about sick time at hospitals. And in my experience with my wife, she's been through the same thing where she doesn't really get paid sick time. However, just Sunday, she had been sick and was over it, but she was less than, you know, 72 hours into symptoms. And so they actually sent her home.
Yeah,
but it was unpaid.
Oh, jeez.
You know,
this is just wrong. This is just wrong. I mean, people, the person who called from the restaurant that did pay sick days, you know, they got a union that they, you know, they're making good money because there are, you know, restaurants like that. And I'm guessing that the people who are being sent home in the hospitals are not the executives who are making $120,000 a year. They're the people who are working on the front lines making $25,000, $30,000, $35,000 a year if they're lucky. And
my wife, She made $34,000 last year.
Yeah, exactly. My point. Okay, Jason, thank you very much, and thanks for sharing that with us. Christopher in Marshall, Michigan. Hey, Christopher. I used to fly into Marshall, Michigan when we lived in Lansing, and I was learning how to fly in the early 70s. There's a restaurant there that we used to fly into just to have dinner at. I'm trying to remember the name of it. I'll bet you know.
Was it the Highlight?
No. This was in 1971, 72. It was right near the airport in Marshall, and it has just escaped my brain. But it was a really nice high-end restaurant there that we would fly in and eat at. It was like our treat for the 6 months, you know. Anyhow, what's up?
It was totally past my time, but yeah. Sounds interesting. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. To make it quick, how's your wife Louise doing?
She's doing great. She's doing. In fact, you talked to her earlier. She's answering phones today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I didn't know that, but that makes me feel really good. You guys are awesome, and I appreciate everything you do. You help my family out so much and more than you know. The first point I would like to make with restaurant business, my fiance worked at a restaurant where they allowed her to have sick days off, and they paid them. It was a pretty high-end place, but the problem was is they only paid her wage, which would only be $2-something an hour. So she never really took any. I mean, she never called in once out of the 4 years she worked there. Yeah. Just because, you know, we couldn't afford it at the time.
Right. So there should be sick pay, which reflects what you actually make. You know, if in a restaurant you average $6 an hour or $12 an hour or $30 an hour, whatever it is, regardless of your base pay, whatever your average is with tips, that really should be your sick pay.
Absolutely. And I agree 100%. The second point I'd like to make about the gun issue is, you know, personally, I like to call it's a failure to gun rights advocates and people fighting for looser gun laws. You know, I really blame them for a lot of things happening because they're out there fighting for, you know, more guns out there on the streets and stuff, but they're not doing a good job with, spreading awareness on gun safety, the extremeness of using a gun,
right,
and how dangerous they are,
right,
more than a law to intervene. I think it's more their failure on their part.
Yeah, we take it very seriously when a 16-year-old gets behind the wheel of an automobile because of the potential to kill somebody or themselves. We don't take it so seriously when they pick up a handgun. And
exactly.
If, you know, when I went through the Georgia Police Academy, I mean, they're really serious about firearms. They, you know, this is an instrument of death. And you treat it with incredible respect. Christopher, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Tim in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Tim, thanks for listening to XM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, nice to talk to you. It's a real honor.
Thank you.
So, I work in retail.
Mm-hmm.
And I get 3 days, or I get paid sick leave, but it doesn't kick in until you're sick for 3 days.
Well, that's an interesting twist to discourage people from using it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, if you're looking out in, you know, grocery stores and all that, especially the non-union stores, I mean, everybody, you know, half the people are sick. It runs through the store just like it does your family.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Yeah. And well, I've seen it in businesses, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, why Louise is answering phones today is because Danielle is running the video machine because Jim, who runs the video machine normally, is homesick with the flu. And we're all hoping that, you know, it doesn't creep around here. So
there you go.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, I work at a community college where guns are actually permitted when they're concealed.
Hmm.
And law enforcement at my particular college is informing all of the students who carry these concealed weapons because they have to notify the school when they do. They are notifying them that if you pull them out and brandish them during an incident at the college, they will shoot on sight because they can't tell who the person is with the gun that is the good guy and who is the bad guy. And if you happen to brandish a gun during a hall when there's a shootout, they will simply shoot whoever has the gun.
Oh, that makes so much sense. So, in other words, if, you know, during the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, if the police had showed up while it was going on and some teachers had been armed and they were standing there trying to shoot at the shooter, the cop runs in, they're just seeing people shooting at each other. They don't know who's the good guy, who's the bad guy.
No, so it not only risks the Samaritan who has the gun, it also puts the officers at jeopardy because they have to try and discern who's the good guy and the bad guy when a half second counts.
Right.
And rather than take that risk, they'll simply shoot you dead and ask the questions later.
Which makes perfect sense.
It's
I mean, it's a foolish move
to have concealed guns.
Yes, that is. That is, Steve, you win the prize for, I mean, there is no prize to give you, but we're kind of short-staffed, so we're not giving away books this week. but that's one of the best points anybody has made on this program in a long, long time. You absolutely validate my belief that we have the smartest listeners on radio. Thank you, Steve, for listening, and thanks for sharing that with us. So, coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. Friday is going to be Brunch with Bernie. Of course, our national town hall meeting with America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. His website, Bernie.org, by the way. Check that out. Drop by Bernie.org and tell him I said hi. And we'll have Bernie on tomorrow. So, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does not run and it does not work well without periodic oiling, maintenance, and participation. That's you and me. Show up. Get out there. Get active. Occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.